I refuse to testify on the grounds that my organs will be chopped up into a patty.
Ah, the 67th Amendment.
For a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
Can you see Captain Blackadder anywhere in this courtroom?
That's him! That's him! That's the man!
Ah! No more questions, sir.
Or you'll be held in contempt of this court.
I have nothing but contempt for this court.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 88. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing today, Andrew?
I'm doing great, Thomas. Are you feeling any better, or how are you doing?
Doing okay. I'm going to make sure to not hit the mute button so that the audience can really hear me just hack up a lung in the background. That's the key to successful podcasting, as everyone knows. I just got a little stupid cold. No big deal, but I am instantly cured by the fact that we're going to be discussing newsworthy items. I can't wait. Every week, this is my favorite show to do. And let's get right to it. What do you think?
Absolutely.
Down.
The law.
Down.
The law.
Down.
The law. Breaking down.
All right. Breaking down the law. So many people asked about this. Ken Ham, if you're not familiar. If you're not familiar with Ken Ham, just go ahead and Google Ken Ham real quick. Just we'll wait. Just go ahead and Google him. Okay. Now you've seen Ken Ham. That guy.
Amish Wolverine. Yeah. Is it Tom and Cecil who call him that?
I can't remember.
It's one of my favorites. So
there's too many good Ken Ham insults to really keep track of. Someone ought to do like a taxonomy of them. But yeah, that guy made a giant stupid ark, right? And then there was a creation museum inside of it, right?
Yeah, it's supposedly a life-size replica of Noah's Ark that was built as a for-profit amusement park, right? And we covered, and I know you covered on your show, the long and convoluted history of how Ken Ham and the entity that he created to build this amusement park, which, by the way, tickets to walk through this life-size replica of Noah's Ark are $40 a piece. Okay, yeah. For adults. So that's a day at Disneyland, right?
But it's anyway. Way more fun.
Yeah, right. Because where else could you see the inside of a boat?
Yeah, where else do you get to see a man riding a velociraptor?
Right. So the idea was this Ark Park applied for various local and state grants and tax exemptions to build this thing.
Because it's going to be such a boon for the economy.
I mean, it's
really
going to be
because that's exactly what Kentucky needs. Like just the second they build this thing, bam, economy.
Right. So that's kind of the backstory. And then why don't you talk about the latest development?
Well, I didn't really look much into it because I planned on listening to Opening Arguments, but I saw, keep seeing the headline that he sold it, to himself for $10 to, I think it was ostensibly to avoid property taxes. Is this right?
So here's the continuing story. So number one, shockingly, the tourism dollars put forth in the study that Ken Ham submitted to the state.
Their projections were maybe just a little exaggerated. Is that
what? Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, at the time when this was challenged by several groups, they pointed out that the group in charge of doing the projections for how much revenue this was going to bring into the state of Kentucky was, in fact, a group with substantial ties to Ken Ham.
Right.
So
yeah.
The idea was this is clearly a fraudulent study. So anyway, Ark Park hasn't generated revenue the way it has been anticipated. And so the Kentucky state legislature passed an attractions tax that basically imposes a tax of 50 cents per ticket on any for-profit museum or attraction or park.
That ought to bring in tens of dollars from the
right within the state of Kentucky. Right. And in fact, there is evidence from the legislative debate. This is why I know the tickets cost $40 because, look, it's Kentucky. Passing a tax in general is kind of a tough thing to do in Kentucky, and taxing something that is used to promote, the Christian worldview, in particular had a lot of sensitivities. So there was debate in the legislature, and basically, you have lawmakers saying, look, they're charging $40 a ticket, right? You're going to tell me 50 cents a ticket is going to make or break that? Come on. So they passed this tax, and then
I can tell you that 50 cents wouldn't make any difference on my decision to go.
Yeah. And so the legislature passes the tax. They send an assessment letter to the ARC Park, and the ARC Park replies, we're a nonprofit ministry, not public amusement, so we don't have to pay it. And then they write back a letter that says, do you remember that whole applying for tax benefits thing? You very specifically created an LLC and signed these documents saying that this was going to be a for-profit amusement park, because if you said you were creating a nonprofit church, we wouldn't have given you those millions of dollars in tax breaks. But in the span of sending that second letter, the ARC Park LLC conveyed the land upon which the ARC Park sits to a nonprofit subsidiary for the sum of $10. And
it's about how much it's pretty accurate, actually.
Yeah. That does not in and of itself obviate the need to pay the tax. But the suspicion is if you put all of the assets of this amusement park under a ministry, then they're going to tee up the argument later on that, look, this land is privately owned by a nonprofit ministry. It is for teaching the gospel, which it is. And that they're using that to tee up an argument down the road that they're not going to have to pay the tax.
Right.
So the story broke on Patheos. It was on the Friendly Atheist blog. And we got several hundred questions of, is this sale legal? And so I went out to research that because let me tell you the way it kind of ping ponged back and forth in my head, right? So the first thing I did was sort of analogize it to if a parent sells a piece of property to a child or to another family member for below market value, right?
Right.
So you have $1 million house, little baby Smith is on the way, and 20 years from now, you decide to sell her your $1 million house for $500.
Right. Doesn't she have to report like the difference between the value and what I gave it to her for in income, or am I crazy?
That is exactly okay. Right. And in particular as gift income.
Gift income, right? Yeah.
So you can give your child right now $11,000 a year tax-free and $1 million for your lifetime.
That's a lot of chores for her to do.
Yes, exactly, right.
I don't think she's quite going to earn that much, but okay, sure.
And she may be a great kid, who knows.
She's going to have to start producing my podcast or something.
But the IRS will look at that and will say, this is $1 million home. The fact that you sold it for $10 does not make it a $10 home for tax purposes. And the way in which we're going to recapture this is by treating the $999,990 difference as a taxable gift from you to little baby Smith, who I guess she's 20 at the time, so no longer a little baby, but whatever, stick with this hypothetical with me. And so then I kind of ping pong back and forth and said, okay, well, if that's the analysis that would apply here, then aren't we going to wind up in trouble because you'll take this land that is valued at $42 million, even though the deed shows like $18 million, right? Like they underestimated the value on the deed and then they sold it for $10. So in any event, tens of millions of dollars of non-captured value. But then I thought, well, if the same analysis applies, you're just making a gift to a tax-exempt 501c3 church ministry. Ooh. And not only is that not a taxable event, but typically you get to deduct that from your taxes.
Oh my gosh.
Right.
Wow, what a scheme.
Right. So I did.
I know this is not hard, but maybe Ken Ham is smarter than he looked. Maybe. I mean, it's. Actually, I'm going to go ahead and say he's 100% has to be smarter than
he was. Yeah, right. That, by definition,
yeah, there's no way he could not be smarter than he was.
But as it turns out, you can't just retroactively declare a transaction to be a charitable gift, right? That in order to donate anything over $5,000 to a charity, you have to get it appraised. You have to specifically document it, right? You have to go through all of these procedures in order to comply with the IRS guidelines. And if you don't do that, then we're back in the land of treating this as a sham transaction. Ooh. So as far as I can tell, that wasn't done, right? This isn't being described as a for-profit company for tax purposes made this charitable donation to a nonprofit entity.
And also, though, wouldn't that be sort of like just tanking a company, you know, for personal gain? I mean, is that like what I don't know what the business structure was, but I know if this was a major corporation, couldn't there be fraud if it was like, yeah, we just gave all our assets away and, you know, defrauded the shareholders
and,
or whatever?
Right. And that's the difference between a publicly held or in particular, a publicly
so
traded
you're allowed
corporation,
to do however stupid of business decisions you want with your own LLC.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, Opening Arguments Media LLC, if we decide, you know, we want to do something ridiculous with it, you and I can collectively decide to do something ridiculous with this business.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. We have to both agree, though. So. But the moment that we have any outside shareholders, then we have a fiduciary duty to those shareholders to act in the best interests of the business, right? So that's where you get, and those rights are called derivative rights. So for example, if you buy, and people, this is a real life example. If you bought shares of Coca-Cola, right, you are technically one of the owners of that multi-billion dollar corporation. And so in 1985, when Coca-Cola decided to change the formula and introduce New Coke, there were shareholder derivative lawsuits that were filed that said to the board of directors, you failed to act in the best interests of the owners of this business, meaning us, and tanked the value of this immensely profitable company by doing something so preposterously stupid that, you know, that the minute it happened, it was met with derision across, you know, the entire world.
I can't wait to see what that movie trial would have been like. Your Honor, yeah, right. Drink this entire Coke. No, it's awful. I can't do it.
Well, actually, I mean, while we're going to stick with the New Coke case, the disposition of those cases went nowhere. there is something called the business judgment rule that basically says, you know, if you're the board of directors of a publicly traded company and you make a decision that is within your legitimate business judgment, the best course of action for the company, then you can't be sued for breach of your fiduciary duty to the shareholders. And so what you have to prove is you have to prove fraud or something similar, right? Like you have to prove that they're not trying to maximize profits. But we tried to maximize profits, but we're all idiots is a perfectly valid defense. And in the New Coke case, it's really, really interesting. This is a little tiny bit of history from before you were born. But in the late 70s, the way in which Pepsi was making inroads on Coca-Cola was by having blind taste tests in malls and other public places across the country. And they filmed them for ads as well. And they called it, you know, take the Pepsi challenge.
Oh,
and basically,
yeah, I kind of remember that.
Yeah. And the argument was, look, we know you're loyal to Coke because of brand loyalty. But when we don't tell you the name of the substance and we have people take Dixie cup sized tastes of Coke and Pepsi, people strongly prefer Pepsi, right? And it was true. And so Coke
isn't that weird, because I would instantly know which one was Coke and which one was Pepsi. Like, it wouldn't matter if it was blind or not for me. I don't get it.
Me too, as a Diet Coke.
I would still prefer Pepsi. Rift in the podcast. Diet Pepsi is so much better than Diet Coke. You're crazy.
See, the thing is, so the answer to that is they were using, and Pepsi,
I'm never letting you get to the end of this arc story.
Yeah, it's fair enough. Pepsi used tiny, tiny cups, right? And Pepsi is objectively sweeter than Coke. And so what happens is when you're tasting really small quantities, all other things being equal, something that is more sweet is going to, in the average palate, is going to register as a better taste because there's just so little of, you know, like you can't get any of the subtle, you know, vanilla and cola flavor, right? You're just tasting, you know, a couple of mouthfuls.
Andrew's and a so Coke it's connoisseur. You can't get the oaky quality of the the almond finish on the Diet Coke.
Well, and look, and this is one of, I mean, to go on a tangent on this tangent, right? This is one of the criticisms against the industry of wine tasting, right? Mm-hmm. That like,
you know,
when you talk about somebody like Robert Parker who tastes, you know, 60 wines in a 2-hour period in these tiny little, that you can't, right?
Right.
Even if your taste buds are amazing.
I know, I don't pretend. That, once I've had like half a glass of wine, everything's the same to me. Like I would, I could be eating food and it'll, it would all be taste like the same food. So the point was
Coke executives, right? So here's the point. Coke executives knew what was going on and reformulated Coke to be the new Coke to be sweeter and then did the same kinds of blind taste testing, did tens of thousands of them, and people preferred new Coke to Pepsi, right? So the entire thing was sort of driven by this, you know, kind of bad science PR stunt. And so the net effect was there was no, you know, corporate mismanagement by
So that's what led to that decision. Did they switch it right back? Is that what happened?
What they did, they announced that it was like within 8 weeks they announced that they were going to be going back, and they tried a variety of things. New Coke was then marketed under a can of, you know, quote, new Coke, and then it was called Coke 2, Roman numeral 2 for a while. And then kind of shelved and put away forever. But the other thing that was effectuated by the switch was even the classic Coca-Cola classic formula, which is what they called it when they brought it back, marked the shift from cane sugar to high fructose corn syrup. So I am not a conspiracy-minded person. I think the evidence from these cases and from the public documents is overwhelmingly clear that what Coke wanted to do was beat Pepsi in the Pepsi challenge. But conspiracy theorists say it was all an elaborate false flag operation to switch over from using Coke with sugar to using Coke with high fructose corn syrup. So take of that as you will. Like I said, no, I put no stock in it. It's just clear. Like we have, both political parties have subsidized corn manufacture in this country to the point where HFCS is like literally cheaper to use in your products than water. And that's why we have like food-like substances with no nutritional value.
Right.
But that's a subject for yet another episode. So,
so the point is, it could be a terrible business decision and it doesn't matter because it's not a publicly traded thingy. But so, but you're saying they needed to do some sort of paperwork or arrangements or something to make it so that it would be a gift to a church or ministry. And you're saying they didn't do that?
If they're going to make that argument. Oh, yeah, that's right. That as far as I can tell, they will not be able to affirmatively raise the argument that this was, I mean, a gift from the for-profit Arc Park to the ministry. And in my view, what's next on deck is the Attorney General of the state of Kentucky needs to bring a fraud lawsuit against all of the ARC entities.
Because
when applying for, I mean, you know, as part of the setup for the story, Ken Ham and his officers signed paperwork that they were going to be creating an attraction open to the public that was for profit. And that's how they qualified for those tax breaks. And so, we have talked about this. It is difficult to prove fraud, but this is not a hard case, right? I mean, among fraud cases, you know, this is the one, you know, if you're hurting for additional legal support in the state of Kentucky, give me a call, right? I have partnered with the city of Baltimore before, right? Like it in private practice, both in my old firm capacity and in my new firm capacity. So I'm not holding out hope that there are a lot of folks in the Attorney General's office in Kentucky who are listening to our show, but they should be. But yeah, no, I would absolutely help them out. So,
legal question: is Kentucky the worst state?
Boy, there's a lot of competition. Because isn't it
Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul, and the Arc Park? I mean, that's already three of the worst things that are in the country. So it's
Kansas has Sam Brownback too. Mm. Like that's Kansas is a pretty strong contender. So let's see how many other states we could do the like cognitive dissonance and could call everything except Maryland and California a garbage state and see how many of our patrons we can offend. We love all of our patrons, even those that come from garbage states. So thank you.
Yeah, because we know they're the only smart people stuck in these garbage states. Exactly.
That's exactly right.
But let this be a lesson to governments. Maybe don't subsidize absurd parks based on really, 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 really stupid ideas that obviously no one would care about seeing. Maybe just.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's exactly right. Like the reason I am coming out very, very strongly is because I would put the odds of the Kentucky Attorney General bringing the fraud suit pretty low.
Yeah, just because of the bias.
I'm hoping that the Attorney General in Kentucky, I'm hoping that that person is, you know, a Rudy Giuliani type and is very, very politically ambitious and thinks, hey, look, if I can recover $50 million for my state, you know, people will remember me as a sharp prosecutor who upheld the law, and they will not remember me as the guy who shut down that canceled Ark Park thing.
That would be nice.
And yeah, no.
But definitely do take theme park advice from a podcast.
This is absolutely 100%. They should bring the lawsuit because it will not be hard to find completely contradictory statements in writing.
Yeah.
You know, intent is always a challenge, but like when I say to you one day X and then I say to you the next day not X, and the only commonality is the thing that I have represented is the thing that requires me to pay the least amount in taxes, right? Yeah. Like, those are cases that prosecutors know how to bring.
Do you think every day Ken Ham was just praying like there was going to be a second flood and then the park would like float away and he would be the like look like a genius? There's got to be 20% of his brain that thinks that. There has to be.
I don't think the boat.
It would not work.
Seaworthy, right? Like
it would be like the first place people die. Like it would be the worst structure.
I have never understood this entire endeavor, right? Yeah. Because the whole point, remember, like maybe we should have done this at the outset, but like Ken Ham's ministry is Answers in Genesis. They're the people that think the earth is 6,000 years old, which is a delusion on the earth. Like literally there is more evidence that the earth is flat and surrounded by a ring of ice than it is that it's 6,000 years old.
Right, because that's true, but yeah.
As part of that, they think that the biblical story of the flood in Genesis is literally true and that an old guy and his, you know, his three sons and wives.
Yeah, it took him like months and months, cranes and like all this technology to build this stupid piece of crap.
It took years and tens of millions of dollars with subsidized tax breaks from the government, right? So like if you're doing, I'm remembering like as long as we're doing all 70s throwbacks on this show, do you know the story? I think it's Thor Heyerdahl.
Not another story. He
sought out to prove that the Vikings could have sailed to the Americas in the 12th century. And so he set out, Thor Heyerdahl, right? He was from Scandinavia. I can't remember which country. But he set out from Sweden or Finland or, you know, one of those, on a raft that was made using nothing but 12th century materials and like sailed across the Atlantic as kind of a feasibility study, right? So that's the whole point of Ken Ham building this museum is to say like, see, look, an 800-year-old man and his sons could have definitely built this. And like,
that's
as soon as you start to look
at
it,
the government
it just collapses.
Should have said, okay, we'll let you do this. Just find an 800-year-old man. And as soon as you have, we'll fund the whole damn thing. As soon as you have an 800-year-old man to test it, you know, rigorously, that's what they should have done. All right, we got to move on. But
there you go. Yeah. The next step is, in my view, is a fraud lawsuit. The transaction. I don't see how this isn't a sham transaction to the IRS.
I want to know, can he push the undo button on this? Can he say, never mind, and then is he fine or is he still like legally...
That'll be in the discretion of the agents, right? Like when you go and there the question is, you know, are they going to move forward to say that this is willful tax evasion? And again, you know, all the same considerations apply. In my view, if you're ever going to make a case for, you know, somebody is very clearly trying to evade their legal obligation to pay taxes, like the stuff Ken Ham has done is textbook. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, thanks for answering that. I know a lot of people had that question. All right. Andrew, I'm told that I can't expect any privacy on my personal computer. Is that right?
Yeah, I wanted to cover this. A couple folks brought this to my attention. This otherwise might have fallen through the cracks, and this is one of the reasons we do the show. So I'm super excited about it. This is a case that just came down last month in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. It is U.S. versus Mattish, M-A-T-I-S-H. It is recent enough that there is not a citation, but I will link to the slip opinion in the show notes. You can read it for yourself. It's a really, really interesting case for the reasons that I'm about to explain. But yes, it is a court in Virginia holding that you have no expectation of privacy on your computer. And I think you're going to see this case cited an awful lot over the next couple of years for the reasons that I'm about to explain. So, facts of the case. And this is, I think this draws on the lesson that we learned from Andrew Seidel on his episodes on the show, which were great. I can't wait to have Andrew back on the show. But it is that bad facts often make really, really bad law. And the reason is, you know, sort of, again, that underlying notion that, you know, no matter how Solomonic or technical or whatever you expect courts to be, they care about what's actually happening as a result of their cases. They care about fairness. And so cases that have very, very unsympathetic parties tend to result in sort of contortions of the law to get to the result that you want to get to. And this is one of those cases. So the defendant in this case was active on the so-called deep web, the Tor browser system, and which is a network. I think this is right. It allows you to access websites that prevent Google and other public search engines from indexing, right? So they're essentially dark sites that you can't ordinarily find. So you get on, you use this Tor browser. The Tor browser, I think, also has some encryption features built into it. And needless to say, when you offer maximum encryption and ostensible privacy, people will use that to do some horrible
things. They're just Googling. I'm sure they're shopping on Amazon a little bit.
Yeah, well, no, you don't want Amazon to find your home address.
Right.
No, wait, no, they're going to ship to your home address. And again, look, like I don't want to come off as not being a friend to the notion that, you know, you should have privacy rights on your computer, right? I mean, that's the whole point of this whole segment. But the facts are there was a site called, and it is referred to in the complaint as Playpen. I don't know if that's a code name or if that's the actual name of the site, but it was a child pornography site.
Oh, God. Okay.
And the FBI found the site. They found the people who were running it. Wow. And the FBI did something it strikes me as very, very unusual. Huh. They continued to operate the site. And what they did was they hired
people.
Yeah, what they did was they hired a guy to write a piece of code that when you logged onto the site would copy itself onto your computer and then
like alert someone.
Upload your information. Okay.
Oh, man.
And that information would include your IP address so that they could find you. So the FBI continued to operate this child porn site for months after busting the original.
That is weird. Okay.
It is weird. And it's one of those, this is not a case about entrapment, although I get the sense.
Yeah, I've been thinking about asking that.
Yeah. I get the sense that may have been raised. This case is a motion to suppress being filed by the defendant that says that. So what happened was the defendant logged on, used the Tor browser, went to the Playpen site, and his address was logged. His IP address was logged. The federal government then got a search warrant, revealed that information. You got the information from the little virusware that was on his computer, and then arrested the guy. He moved to suppress the information, which would essentially amount to a dismissal of the case because it would, we've talked about this in search and seizure cases. It would also, if his IP address was illegally obtained, then everything obtained subsequent to that is also the tainted fruit of the poisonous tree at all also has to be suppressed. So he's moving to suppress, and the court has denied that motion to suppress. Okay, for the reasons that I'm about to get into. But the significance of this from a procedural posture is when you appeal a case, you can only appeal a final judgment. Okay, and different things count as a final judgment, right? Like a verdict against you is obviously a final judgment. In most cases, a granting a motion for summary judgment can be a final judgment, right? But, and this is, and I don't want to get sort of bogged down on marginalia, but denying a motion to suppress is not a final judgment, right? Mm. So in other words, this opinion is going to stand while the underlying trial takes place. And when a conviction, if a conviction is handed down, which seems pretty likely in this case. If a conviction is handed down, when that conviction is handed down, you will then have a final judgment and you will be able to appeal that final judgment on the basis that the trial court should have suppressed the evidence. But the key issue is this defendant is not going to be able to file that appeal until then. And so this case is going to stand in the meanwhile, right? And as prosecutors and as defense attorneys are looking through on Lexis in similar cases, this case is going to pop up. And so what does this case say and why is it significant? So the first thing that the case does is it says that the search warrant was validly issued. I'm not going to talk about that at all because it's not interesting. If that's all this case said was, no, look, the federal government went, they got their search warrant, and then they got your IP address.
Boring.
This would be... Yeah.
Not, that's no not opening arguments caliber right there.
Yeah. It would have no significance whatsoever. We would have some significance, but we wouldn't be covering it. But then to judges, particularly trial court judges, are really sensitive about being overturned by appellate courts. Mm-hmm. And so they try and do things that we call bulletproof their opinions to make it such that there's no grounds for the appellate court to reverse. And so in this case, the district court says, but even if the warrant wasn't validly issued, it nevertheless is a good search here because we didn't have to get a warrant. The police and the prosecutor didn't have to get a warrant in this case. And when do you not have to get a warrant? You don't have to get a warrant, among other things.
I'm glad you're not asking me. I was going to try to say, like, imminent danger or something, or what was it?
There's the exigent circumstances are one such thing. But this case was not about exigent circumstances. That would be really, really tough when it's the government itself running the website.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like, the harm that's being done is being perpetrated by the government. And there's a really interesting case there that we, you know, we can't really talk about right now. Additionally, you don't need a warrant if somebody didn't have an expectation of privacy for the thing that you seize, right? So let me give you an example. There is a case that is called Minnesota versus Carter.
Is this like you can go through someone's trash can?
Exactly right.
I knew it.
All of these are exceptions to the warrant requirement. If I throw something in the trash can and then put it out on the street, you don't need a search warrant to search my trash can, right? Because I've said it's garbage. I'm throwing it away. and so you have no, right? The Fourth Amendment protects you in your person's, homes, papers, and effects from illegal search and seizure, but you know, it doesn't protect you in your garbage. It doesn't protect you when you're on the street. It doesn't protect you when you don't have, and the key phrase is, a reasonable expectation of privacy. So Minnesota versus Carter is a case about when a police officer looked through the gap in blinds leading into a person's house, right? So if you've ever had like crappy Venetian blinds in an apartment, right, sometimes, you know, the blinds, you pull them down, you shut them, but sometimes one of the blinds is kind of bent or, you know, doesn't fully close and there's a gap and, you know, somebody could technically see in. And this case said, if you do that and you haven't bothered to replace the blinds and you don't go over and fix that little gap, then you don't have an expectation of privacy of what's going on inside. And so it was okay for the police officer to kneel in the front yard and peer through the blinds and observe what's going on inside, that they didn't need to get a search warrant to do that. Okay. Now I'm not convinced by the logic of that case,
but I'm
sort of showing where the consensus of Fourth Amendment law has gone and that it really does sort of turn on the notion of, do you have an expectation of privacy?
Okay.
And that's why this case is significant, because the court said, even if the reason that the police did not have to obtain a search warrant in this case is because, first, you have no expectation of privacy on your computer for your IP address. Okay. This is page 43 of the opinion. And it says, IP addresses are not merely passively conveyed through third-party equipment, but are voluntarily turned over in order to direct the third-party servers. Even if you are using the Tor network to mask your IP address, you lack a reasonable expectation of privacy in your IP address because you ought to know that that information is discoverable.
Okay, so this is maybe not exactly what I thought, if I'm understanding this right, because it sounds like when you hear the headline of expectation of privacy on your PC, it doesn't necessarily, unless I'm crazy, it doesn't necessarily mean like, well, you can't expect that your browsing is private. It's more like the IP address, you can't expect that that in particular is private. Is that right?
That's right for this portion of the opinion.
Okay. It goes
but
on. Okay.
You have anticipated, right? So we go through and maybe you're sort of persuaded that, because again, remember the blinds example, right? Like, in my view, the reasonable expectation of privacy is, have I manifested objective indicia that I expect that this thing is going to be private, right? And to me,
well, you
shutting
definitely
the blinds,
expect this to be private, I would think. I'm so pretty sure everyone who's looking at child porn expects that experience is private, right. But that's just me.
So
he's not going to touch that one. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to leave that one right where it is.
Sure.
But no. So that's what this opinion is sort of struggling uphill against. And it wants to say you do not have a reasonable expectation. And again, reasonable includes both the subjective and the objective components. Right. Like, so, you know, that's the trash example, that we both agree is a reasonable exception to the Fourth Amendment. You are neither subjectively nor objectively manifesting an intent to keep something private when you throw it in a trash can and carry it out to the street.
Right.
Right. Some people argued subjectively, no, look, like I put the lid on the trash can. I don't think people are going to come through and rummage through my shit. Right. Like, so, and then in that case, the court says, well, even if you had a subjective intent, objectively, you should have known.
The fact that a raccoon
known.
Could get at what
right.
you're
yeah.
saying
exactly.
was private.
Right.
I mean, that the raccoon test yeah. should be what
right.
it is.
That defeats that. So the court has to argue here that using the Tor network is like the raccoon test. And I don't know that that passes it. But assume that you nevertheless are persuaded by that. I think you're probably not going to be persuaded by subsection B of the opinion, begins on page 47, in which the court says, but even if you do, but even if you don't buy that, you should know that the defendant has no reasonable expectation of privacy in his computer.
Yeah, I don't know
okay.
about that.
In describing the place to be seized, right, because that's what you need for Fourth Amendment purposes, this court says you have no expectation of privacy on your personal computer. And the reasons that it gives for that is, for example, hacking is much more prevalent now than it was even 9 years ago, and the rise of computer hacking via the internet has changed the public's reasonable expectations of privacy. Now it seems unreasonable to think that a computer connected to the web is immune from invasion. Indeed, the opposite holds true. In today's digital world, it appears a virtual certainty that computers accessing the internet can and eventually will be hacked. For example, terrorists no longer can rely on Apple to store their electronically, to protect their electronically stored private data, right? And so they go through that. And so literally the argument is you do not have an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy on your personal computer
that
at home so
ridiculous.
Long as it's connected
Any
to the internet.
Any building you're in, well, a thief could get in it, so you can't expect that it's private, right?
And the conclusion, even Tor users cannot reasonably expect to be safe from hackers, even if the users hope that the network will keep certain information private, just as terrorists seem to expect Apple to keep their data private. It is unreasonable not to expect that someone will be able to gain access. And it quotes this blogs of war site that says, describing the federal government discovered a way to identify the true IP addresses of an unknown number of Tor users, and noting that this development
should... This is a crap argument, right? Am I crazy?
...serve as a... Yeah. a huge wake-up call to people who believe that using Tor endows them with unassailable privacy protections. I'm pointing this out because, you know, we laugh about, you know, deep staters and conspiracy theorists and people who argue that, you know, the government is out there, you know, secretly collecting all your information and that, but like, that's the people that the court are citing, that the court is citing in this opinion, right? It's saying, look, even, you know, people who are the strongest privacy advocates online admit that they're scared about their privacy being hacked online, and therefore they shouldn't reasonably expect to have any privacy online. Wow. It's an amazing decision and potentially terrifying. And again, because of the procedural history that I went through, is going to be unchallenged for over a year, for a year and a half, 2 years, however long it's going to take for trial, verdict, and appeal.
Wait, so it has to be unchallenged that whole time?
Right, because remember, this is a collateral opinion.
Right.
This does not, this just prevents the defendant from, it denies the defendant's motion to suppress the evidence. So he can't appeal this ruling until he's convicted of the underlying charges. So yeah, it's going to stand for a year, 2 years. And cases, again, it's only binding. It's only law of the circuit in the Eastern District of West Virginia. But it will be cited as persuasive authority in my view, in cases everywhere. So really should have gotten a lot more attention, really represent. And again, this is something where, you know, we've talked about online privacy protections. We did our multi-part episode on the, you know, net neutrality and online privacy rules. This is a real issue, and we're not going to get any help.
Well, you heard it here first. Andrew Torres comes down on the side of child porn users. So you heard it here first, everyone. No, that really sounds like a bad argument. I don't even get it. I can't believe that. So I guess we'll have to hope that nothing breaks for a year or something. But
that seems like a good thing to hope for. That's worked out real well so far, hasn't it?
What an interesting case. Wow. Okay. Well, thanks for covering that. Let's go on to, we're on to Yodel Mountain, Andrew.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Okay, Andrew, we're on Yodel Mountain. We are on Yodel Mountain. And what was the name of our 60s folk band? Was it Yodel Mountain Conspiracy? Was that what it was?
Yodel Mountain Conspiracy.
Totally
could
be.
Ladies and gentlemen, get out your peace pipes and welcome. Yodel Mountain Conspiracy.
Oh, man.
The folk stylings of Yodel Mountain Conspiracy.
It could easily be a band from the 60s. There was just such a weird name. Maybe early 70s, too. All right.
Can we put out a guy? We should recognize fans who came up to us at the... at the Inciting 100th Incident. Live episode of the Inciting Incident podcast, where you and I did a fantastic live show. I think it was well received. And we were gifted a laser disc copy.
Oh my God.
Of The Firm, which was the greatest
present that's ever, to this day and through the birth of my child in a month here, it still will not compete with receiving a laser disc copy of The Firm. Which, by the way, I think it's like two or three discs. Like, it's the most.
Oh yeah,
it's the stupidest. Yeah. right now, okay. If there's a lawsuit for old New Coke, there's got to be a lawsuit for Laserdisc, because that was the stupidest format. Like, who in the world thought that was going to be a good idea?
Do you like LPs and do you like movies? How about, you know, the two great tastes that taste great together? Yeah, I'm going to have this thing framed.
Yeah,
and,
do you like stopping a movie four or five times in the middle of it to turn over a 50-pound disc? And like put it in a thing, and then you probably have to pull like a cord to like get the diesel engine started, like to run the stupid thing. It was just so dumb.
The cow says boo.
Anyway, Yodel Mountain Conspiracy.
Anyway,
I thought you were going to say we should come up with a track list for the Yodel Mountain Conspiracy band, but
Yeah, I want someone to come up to us at a convention or at one of our live shows and present us with tie-dye shirts that say Yodel Mountain Conspiracy.
That's a good one. I thought you were going to say someone needs to give us a damn Laserdisc player, because I don't know how we're watching the firm without it. Patreon goal, anyway. Get a Laserdisc player, and we'll go watch the... all of us, a bunch of listeners, too. Let's do it. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So for today's... today's hits from the Yodel Mountain Conspiracy. You have talked, I know last time we already covered getting opposition research from a foreign entity, and you had a question because you're not an election lawyer. Pfft, I don't know why not, but I guess apparently you don't know everything, Andrew. that you weren't sure if like that's clearly a thing of value or not, because there's definitely a prohibition against getting any sort of like contributions from foreign entities, right? So I hear you spoke to an election lawyer, right?
I did. I spoke with a partner at a law firm in Washington, D.C., and she works with nonprofit political organizations, 501c4s. So she is an elections law expert. She also, her undergraduate degree is in Russian literature. So I expect that her services will be in
she's
tremendous
preparing all her
very,
life
very
for
soon.
This like year.
Yeah. And we're gonna have her on the show.
Ooh.
But so I posed this question, and she basically said, you know, even a non-expert like me could very easily sort of look through the relevant case law, and that in her opinion that the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission, issues opinion letters all the time with respect to contributions to campaigns where they have contributed intangible goods, and they are nevertheless held to be a, quote, thing of value. And oftentimes, you know, the FEC will say, look, you shouldn't have done that. This is a thing of value, but it's, you know, it's kind of a de minimis. So we're not going to, you know, file charges or whatever, but it's still a bad thing. You still shouldn't have done this. It still, you know, violates the law. So let's take a look at the actual law. It begins with 52 U.S.C. 30121. Title 52 of the U.S. Code is what covers elections law, and this specific provision says, it shall be unlawful for, one, a foreign national, directly or indirectly, to make, capital A, a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value. Okay. So that's really, 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 really clear. And when we've talked about the Trump campaign and Donald Trump Jr. meeting with Russian officials and facilitating the delivery of opposition research, hacked emails from Hillary Clinton, if that opposition research is considered a thing of value, you now have, I mean, this is clear as Kushner, right?
Ooh.
That would violate this provision.
That
right?
should you give have, us comfort, except that Kushner still exists and is fine and no one cares about it. But I got to ask you, that law sounded like, is there another clause or whatever? Because that sounded like it was directed at the foreign person. Like, is that?
It is. Okay. Right. But remember the what we're talking about is the framework
conspiracy?
For a conspiracy.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So if you're facilitating a Russian national to make an illegal campaign contribution, you are now guilty of conspiracy to violate 52 U.S.C.
So there isn't like another clause that's like, also you can't accept this stuff. It's just the conspiracy part is what covers that.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So yeah, the rest of it, I mean, the rest of the statute says, or to make an implied or
well,
express
hold on.
Promise
so let me,
to make a
question
contribution.
Then. If somebody, if conspiracy is the problem, if you just find on your, you know, office chair one day, a bound set of documents that like, you know, it's from a foreign entity, but you had no part in soliciting it or whatever. Can you just use it?
Nope. Subsection two
prohibits
a person to solicit, accept, or receive a contribution or donation described in the previous paragraphs.
Okay.
So yeah, it's locked down. And these are really good points that you're making, because it is clear as you're trying to ascertain sort of the intent of Congress in passing the section, that they wanted to button it up in every conceivable way, right? Like we have, it is astonishing to me right now, I guess it shouldn't be from political partisanship, but the idea that you would downplay the historical significance that politicians from both parties have had about foreign governments, particularly Russians,
I cannot believe
interfering in our elections is just—it's just amazing.
Ronald Reagan must be doing 360s in his grave right now. He really, It's amazing to me. The idea that his party is like, just, we're cool with just, you know, Russia intervening with our election. Who cares? Doesn't matter.
And I mean, it's one of those where, you know, you would hope that even if the statutes were not sort of buttoned all the way up, that you would sort of look to the intent behind it and say, I cannot imagine a more significant crime against the United States than to facilitate interfering with a democratic election, right? Like, that's the crime, right? Like, this is, you know, to cross over the rant I had on another podcast, right? Like, that's why Pete Rose is banned from the Hall of Fame, right? Like, when you do something that challenges the integrity of the process itself, right? There's literally nothing worse that you can do. Right. Like overturn, like not having a democratic election is the worst thing you can do in a democratic society. So anyway,
now's the time where I want to go through all the stupid defenses they've offered, because I'm pretty sure the answer is none of it is a good defense. Because even if he was saying, now let's pretend, because I think this is something they offered. Oh, well, I thought they've said, you know, it's just opposition research. Like they thought, you know, the Russian government did some Googling for them and like found some like publicly available documents. Even if that was true, it sounds like it doesn't matter. It sounds like this doesn't have to be like illicit, you know, like information. It doesn't have to be anything illegally obtained. It's even if it was just a valuable set of research, right?
Right. And so the question there is, does a thing of value include intangible information? So let's look at a couple of different cases. Mm-hmm. I'm going to link them in the show notes. The first is U.S. v. Schwartz, 763 F. 2nd, 1054. This is a Ninth Circuit case from 1985, but still good law. And it collects cases from other circuits, right? We know the Ninth Circuit is only binding on West Coast states, but it shows the consensus among the circuits. And here's some of the language. And I should add, both of these cases involve the phrase a thing of value from bribery statutes, right? So they're elsewhere in the U.S. code. You could make the argument that Congress intended to use the same phrase in different places in the U.S. code in different ways, but there's no evidence for that proposition. But again, in the interest of full disclosure, I want to point out that these are bribery cases. These are not elections cases.
Okay.
And the reason they're not is because the Russians have never been permitted by one candidate to hack our elections before.
Oh, man.
Anyway, so here's the Ninth Circuit. They say, the question of first impression left for this court to decide, therefore, is whether, as a matter of law, the statutory scope of thing of value is broad enough to include the intangible of, in this case, it was providing assistance in arranging a merger between two unions, right? In analyzing the question, you know, we presume the indictment to be true. To determine the scope of the section, we look to the language of the statute. If that language is unambiguous, we will regard that as conclusive. And furthermore, when a term such as thing of value has not been specifically defined in the statute, we will assume the ordinary meaning of the words and express the legislative intent behind them. Defendants urge that thing of value should be limited to tangible things with ascertainable monetary value. Ordinarily, however, the measure of value is not limited to commercial or monetary worth. We have recognized a common, broader interpretation of value. In a previous case, U.S. v. Schecker, we held that information can be a thing of value. For instance, state secrets might trade hands without cash consideration. Information obtained for political advantage might have value apart from its worth in dollars. Mm. In each case, the information sought would have value to others in addition to the seeker. And then they say, indeed, the value commonly extends in scope to include intangibles has been the conclusion of various courts when faced with the task of construing criminal statutes that contain the term thing of value. So then they quote a Seventh Circuit case in which thing of value was the labor of a government employee. So that, again, that seems sort of dead on here. Like, at minimum, if you're talking about dropping off a dossier, right? Somebody had to do that work. Somebody had to compile that information. And the information itself, if non-public, also has value. The Seventh Circuit squarely held that intangible services constitute a thing of value. The Second Circuit held that the sale of information is a thing of value, reasoning that these words are found in so many criminal statutes throughout the United States and that they have since become words of art. The word thing notwithstanding, the phrase is generally construed to cover intangibles as well as tangibles. And so in that case, they noted that things of value could include amusement, right, for purposes of criminal bribery, right, taking a taking a legislator to Las Vegas.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And that's actually the case.
Yeah.
Sexual intercourse or the promise of sexual intercourse. That should sort of go without saying. The promise to reinstate an employee and an agreement not to run in a primary election. So I will also point to, but I'm not going to read from a case called U.S. versus Sun Diamond Growers of California. It is a D.C. circuit case, but it also collects a bunch of these cases. And I could go through all the examples.
Well, do you need to? I mean, it seems clear as freaking Kushner that this is something of value. Like, it doesn't seem that hard to me.
I think that's absolutely right. And so to me, that just completely responds to all of the sort of nonsense arguments. Meeting with the Russians to facilitate the delivery of information that the Russians believed would influence an election is very clearly conspiracy to violate the election laws, right? The Russians couldn't do it on their own.
Right.
If they show up on your doorstep and say, hey, you know, we have this great oppo and do the reverse. Right. Like, look, if the Russian showed up at Hillary Clinton's, house in Chelsea and said, we got a great oppo file on Donald Trump. Right. We've got the whole hotel thing with the video and you can't take that. Right.
Right.
And there's a good reason why you shouldn't be able to take that, because we don't want the Russians to determine the outcome.
And a million good reasons. And the other thing is, I think we already covered it, but it doesn't matter whether or not they actually gave them anything, right? Like, just in the email already that was released, isn't that enough? Like, he was clearly conspiring to do this thing.
Correct. Remember, and we're going to talk about actually next week. Since we're out of segments this week, I've got a follow up question on how conspiracy works. So, stay tuned for that on Tuesday. But let me say, as a bit of a preview, to prove the conspiracy, remember that the overt act is one overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy, right? So stick with our Ocean's 11 example. At the moment where, you're the Chinese gymnast and you climb out of the box and you turn off the alarm, even if nobody, right, there's still the whole rest of the Rube Goldberg device to get the money out of the safe. Even if the money never comes out of the safe, even if nobody ever does that, you have now committed that overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. And anybody who's agreed in the conspiracy, even if they have never committed any overt acts, is now, they're all equally liable for all the acts done in furtherance of the conspiracy. So,
I saw someone float a theory. And it is difficult in this day and age to not be a conspiracy theorist when it comes, because there's actual conspiracy going on. But I wonder what you think about it. I'm just curious. It doesn't matter, but I'm just curious for your opinion. Someone thought the email was so obvious and so explicit that, like, were they almost setting him up, like, to be able to leverage him later on? Because it was like, here's all you need to be charged with conspiracy to commit it. Like, it was so overt. It was like, hi, we are the Russians. We would like to give you something illegal. Yes or no? Sure.
Have you seen the Beavis and Butthead movie, or does that predate you by too much chance? There's a delightful scene in which the police officers are attempting to get Beavis and Butthead convicted of solicitation of the prostitute, and you see the undercover officers in their monitoring van going, come on, just say I want to have sex in exchange for money. And it's Beavis and Butthead. So they're just like laughing and mumbling and saying, like, are we going to do it? And, and like using all these euphemisms. Yeah. It's hilarious. Right. And then as soon as the officers run off and the undercover prostitute leaves, they look at each other and says, we were going to exchange cash or services for sexual favors. But so other than that delightful trip down Beavis and Butthead memory lane, I mean, in a sense, it doesn't matter, right? Like, even if it would not surprise me, right? If what we're asking is, do you think the political operations arm of the Russian Secret Service wanted not only to influence the election, but gain blackmailable information.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't really make a difference. It's just a funny thing to speculate about.
Like, that strikes me as very, very plausible that, like, the ideal way to do that is to get somebody to do your dirty work, hopefully win, and also, by the way, you now have blackmailable material on them. So, I have no evidence for it, but it certainly strikes me as plausible.
I think the guy who rips us off all the time, whose show I love, John Oliver. By the way, he's been off for the month of July. I think it was just to stock up on opening arguments episodes.
Yeah.
But I think he puts it best when he calls it stupid Watergate. It's so true. It's just a stupid version of Watergate.
Keep in mind, Watergate itself was pretty stupid.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, Watergate was brought down. The scandal that was Watergate was set into motion by the fact that President Nixon's dirty tricks team, put duct tape over a handle and a janitor found it.
Wow.
Right? Like, that's what set everything in motion. So, we're not talking about, the like local Mensa meeting to start with.
Right.
When I was in college, I did all my grocery shopping at the Safeway that was then in the basement of the Watergate.
Oh, interesting. So there you go. I mean, it seems clear as Kushner. It really does. I mean, that yodeler. Okay. Final question. And I should have, people have asked this, and I don't think we've answered this part. What does it matter for Trump himself, though? I mean, if let's say our dream comes true and finally someone does something about the illegal bullshit that's going on here, does that just mean Trump Jr. is serving a light sentence, or like, what does that mean for Trump himself?
Yeah, well, again, if you had an objective body instead of the House of Representatives mm-hmm. evaluating this, the question you would have to ask, right? Because the defense that President Trump is going to offer is, well, I didn't tell Donald Trump Jr. to do this, and I had no idea what he was doing with the campaign, and it's not like I've got a lot of contact with. I mean, like, those are the things you say when it is a campaign staffer, right? Like, that's what Chris Christie said during Bridgegate was.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I never said, it was my underlings who said time to cause some trouble in Fort Lee. I never told them to do that.
Right.
I certainly didn't wink and clap them on the back and buy them drinks when they told me about it. Like, they all did it on their own, and I'm just an innocent victim. That's a really hard argument to make when it is your son and prominent campaign spokesperson, right? I mean, it to say, no, I didn't have any contact with Donald Trump Jr. between July and November is gonna be a tough argument.
But then you'd also get Trump Jr. I'm sure he would be like, no, I never told him. I didn't, I'm sure he would kind of fall on the sword.
Yeah, of course he's gonna say that. But again, these are not hard cases for, I was going to say smart prosecutors, but like, these are not hard cases for dumb prosecutors to bring, right? Like, when you bring any kind of conspiracy case and you have one person sort of obviously taking the fall for everyone else, right? You tell the jury, like, yeah, you've heard the testimony of a loyal son that, he never told this information to his father. But I ask you to weigh that testimony against these 97 documented appearances between July and October, July and November 4th, right? Like, it's not, and use your best judgment. And if you really believe the story that the defense is telling you, that after getting this information, Donald Trump Jr. was racked with guilt and kept it private and never disclosed, despite the fact that in the middle of a debate, Donald Trump called for the Russians to hack into Hillary Clinton's emails. If you believe all that, then, I guess vote to acquit. But, I don't know that I believe that, and I don't think you should either. Right. Like, that's the case I would think.
All right. Well, there you go. Clear as Kushner. Okay. Now it's time for our co-favorite time of the week. Please, month. It's every week. It is Hall of Fame Patron Friday.
So thank you to Roger, Cases 1 in 30 Minutes or Your Pizza's Free, Metcalf, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast, Steve Sigmund, Jim Grove, Amanda Lipnack, Heather Loveridge, Geeker41, Sean Pitty, Ian and Alley, Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall, Heath Enright, Jeffrey Maynor, The Wayward Willis, Detective Matthew Maxson, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Sharon Frankel, host of the delightful podcast Habeas Humor. Thank you to Squickthinger, Ian Ryan, Matthew Hillier, Aaron Grady, Brandon Smith, TV is My Girlfriend, C6 Sarah, Hunter Ash, Torsten Skurve, and Adopt a Homeless Pet, and Oppose Declawing an Ear Doctor.
And thank you so much to Philip Stromberg. You Are Here Sci-Fi Audio Drama. Thanks, Brian. RJ, also not a criminal defense attorney, Radio. Legalize the Purge. Stephen Boyd at DJ Empirical. CampQuest.org. CampQuest.org. Torsten Peel of ProsperityKarma.org and PlaceboMart.com.
I have to jump in because Torsten Peel of PlaceboMart.com sent me some placebos.
Oh.
I posted it on my Facebook page. So if you want to see all the great products you can get at PlaceboMart.com, we have these placebos.
Did they solve your problems or something?
You. They solved it as well as any homeopathic medicine could.
JT Star Crit Fails the Bar. Soggy Pants. Sammy, Carl Zippel, Squaring the Strange Podcast, Sam Deneau, please use this spot to promote a cause of your choosing. Impeach Trump. Greg Sullivan, Garrett Thomas Fox, the Libertarian, Malaika Chandler, a new lefty blog, sinistermarginalia.net. John Bodley, Kaylee Reiser, Sakashite Fukusumi has nothing to promote. Michael Schaefer, Reason Real Estate, The Electronic Frontier Foundation at EFF.org, The NetSec Heathen, Jessica Wilson, Mark Smith, Thomas McCormick, Mitchell, Frederick Alstromer, Michael Rops, Conrad Michaels, and Zabby. Whew, thank you guys so much for being our top patrons.
Yeah, thank you all very much.
We're getting so close. I want to do that live show. If the inciting incident was any indication, we've got lots of fun stuff planned. It'll be really fun. So hopefully we get there soon.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, now it's time for the bar. I was on such a good streak. I was this close to 50%, and then my dreams fell apart in front of me. So I guess we'll see if I can recover. I didn't pass, right? Oh, man.
So Thomas, a small-town police officer, pulled over a driver for speeding. He believed that the driver was acting irritable and fidgety, but had no articulable reason to think anything was wrong. He searched the car anyway and found two cartons of freshly canned peaches, which were owned by the driver's neighbor and reported stolen off her porch 24 hours earlier. Authorities charged him with theft under the state criminal code. His motion to suppress the evidence because of an unlawful search was denied. On appeal, will the appellate court likely reverse the lower court decision denying the motion to suppress?
Huh.
Okay? So straight question. We've actually talked about this issue, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Oh, God. We have?
A, yes, because the search was unconstitutional. Well, I mean, we didn't talk about peaches, yeah, but, you know.
Hold on. Give me a minute. I'm going to go listen to all our previous episodes. Be right back.
Yeah. OA 54, which was on the law of peaches. No, don't be distracted by the peaches. This is how they get you.
What makes you think I'm distracted by the peaches?
This is how Big Bar Review. All right. A, yes, because the search was unconstitutional due to the officer having no reasonable suspicion that would justify searching the car. B, yes, because when a car is pulled over for speeding, the officer must always obtain a search warrant prior to making a search. C, no, the stop and search were within the normal bounds of propriety for a speeding stop. Or D, no, because the driver being fidgety is enough for probable cause for a full search of the vehicle.
Oh, man. Well, this is hard because I thought the police officer had to, like, at least ask permission. But so he hasn't done that. So I don't know what to assume there. Like, he just did it with, I don't know. Obviously, it doesn't matter for the question, but I'm having a hard time figuring out why that doesn't matter.
Well, you might want to think about why you have the belief that in an ordinary situation, the officer has to ask for your permission.
I don't need your charity, Andrew.
All right, that's fine.
I very much do need your charity. All right, I'm going to go ahead and say, oh, now I got to eliminate two. I forgot about that because I was such a failure last week. Jeez. I think if he said, because it says there's no articulable reason to think anyone's wrong, I think the answers have got to be either yes or no. So
you're gonna eliminate all the maybe answers?
Oh, yeah.
That's good.
Eliminate all the I'm eliminating all the non yes or no answers. That's gotta be some, right? Okay. So now what am I left with? I seem to be left with four answers. Oh man. I don't think that an officer has to obtain a search warrant prior to making a search. So I'm gonna eliminate B because I'm pretty sure you can search. You don't have to like call a judge and stuff like that. Unless the search warrant I'm eliminating that one. And then I guess I'm going to eliminate C because the stop and search were within the normal bounds of propriety for a speeding stop. That sounds weird to me. I don't think that's right. So I'm eliminating B and C So I think it's either a question of, is being fidgety enough of a reason to search the car or not? Which is my issue spotting going on. I'm going to say yes, because the search was unconstitutional due to the officer having no reasonable suspicion that would justify searching the car. I feel like he's got to make an articulable reason. If he wanted to argue, like, well, he, you know, something, then maybe that we would be somewhere. But I don't think you can just search it with no articulable reason. I'm going to go with A, hoping it's the easy, obvious answer.
All right. And if you would like to play along with Thomas, maybe guess D, which Thomas almost guessed.
Yeah, that's good odds there.
Under ordinary rules of Thomas's second chance law firm, or any of the other answers, A, B, C, they're all good answers except for the ones that are false. Play along with us on Twitter, Facebook, retweet, or share out our episode and include with it your reasons and your answer. And we will pick one of you and shower you with never-ending fame, fortune, and adoration in Tuesday's episode.
Yep. All right. Well, here we go. Can I get back on track? We'll find out. So play along. It's always fun. And with that said, that's it for today. What a great episode, Andrew. Really good work, sir. I love this one. So much cool stuff that we covered. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we will see you on Tuesday.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.